The content of this program is intended for people who are blind and print impaired. Hello, this is Anna Dean Silver from the North Carolina Reading Service, and this is Out in the Garden. For the next half hour, I will be reading to you from the book by Margaret Roach, A Way to Garden, a hands-on primer for every season. And we start today again in the chapter Birth for March and April. And we start with why seedlings stretch and get spindly. I haven't had a single spindly stretched out seedling since I started carrying my baby plants outside on each fair day during their young lives. But it took a conversation with a plant physiologist to get me to see the light, literally. Why do vegetable seedlings stretch and grow spindly? And can I prevent it? That was how I began to a note to Thomas Nils Erik Borkman, professor of crop physiology at Cornell, a botanist whose research focuses on the effects of environmental stimuli on plant growth and development, particularly in vegetables. Are leggy seedlings reaching for light, or is something else at work? Scientific papers I've read listed a range of causes. Too little light, maybe also too much. Light's intensity. Temperature, even the day-to-night drop. Improper use of fertilizers. Leaving seedlings in germination chamber conditions, which is extra warm and extra humid, for too long. The list went on. Even factors like spacing apparently can affect the way seedlings grow. But all the cited research happened in light and climate-controlled conditions of labs or commercial greenhouses, not in a home seed-starting environment. What could I do better? The stretching that home seedlings experience is almost entirely from insufficient light, Borkman said. Those other factors play smaller roles, but we can safely concentrate on making the light brighter. That surprised me, since the improved T5 fluorescent tubes under my reflective seed starter hood look so bright, and I keep them on close to the seedlings 12 hours a day. Our eyes have an incredible capacity to adjust to different light intensities, Borkman explained, which makes it easy to underestimate how dim the light really is for seedlings. Putting them by a window is rarely enough. Fluorescent lights are rarely enough, unless they are almost touching the plants. But that can get hot. And then, to really make certain he made his point, the scientist offered data, truly startling numbers, measured in micromoles per square meter per second. Under regular fluorescent lights, the old-style ones, the light output is typically 50 to 100. Even with super high output fluorescent lights spaced 2 inches apart, brighter than my current T5 tube setups, we can get to 400. But with a cloudy day outside in spring in my region, 500 to 800 is common. And on a clear day in late May, when volunteer seedlings would be up and growing on their own, the light will be 1,500 to 2,000. The advances in new LED fixtures hold promise for putting out concentrated light with low heat, and I am watching as prices come down. Meantime, once the seedlings' true leaves appear, out go my seedling flats on each fair day, at first into a protected bright spot, and then gradually into the open, where a bit of breeze makes them stronger, too. Part of each day, or all day, on blustery or cold days, I use the lights to total about 12 hours of exposure. My seedling physiology crash course with Borkman included a bonus element. Don't leave germinating heat mats under the flats or clear plastic domes over the flats once the seedlings poke through the soil surface. If the cotyledons, the seed leaves, even peak up above the soil surface in a hot, humid germination chamber, they'll quickly put up the dreaded thread-thin hypocotyles, the stem beneath those seed leaves. With brassicas, for example, Borkman needs to get them out of the lab's chamber within 36 hours. I shudder to think of the brassicas I have probably steamed before their time. Another benefit to my outdoor regimen, by transplanting time, my seedlings are already hardened off. To minimize shock, I transplant on an overcast day when it isn't too windy, or best of all, just before a gentle rain. Our next topic is making a bed with cardboard. There are various more backbreaking ways to make a new garden bed. But in recent years, I've often relied on the magic of recyclables, newspaper, and cardboard. It's not all about being lazy or getting older and less inclined toward the heroic double digging of my first years here. Prepping a bed without turning or tilling may actually help reduce the number of weed seeds that sprout. For all of us needing a shortcut, it's a good thing that cardboard is considered safe for garden use. Whether a sunny patch of lawn is destined to house tomatoes, or this fall's bulb garden, or an existing border needs some weed smothering, use the plain brown stuff, not versions that are printed with colored ink. Likewise, collect black and white newspaper, not glossy magazines or slick special color sections. Many modern inks are soy-based, but be extra safe. The explanation below assumes decent underlying soil. Neither bog nor wasteland nor highly compacted with mostly herbaceous vegetation, like lawn, not a blackberry thicket. If the residents are tougher than turf grass or the equivalent, first use a spading fork and dislodge, then remove weedy or woody clumps after a good rain, or put a sprinkler on the area beforehand. Over the weeded area or right over turf mown short, layer on newspaper thickly or spread out flattened corrugated cardboard as the underlayment. moisten the paper, and pin it down with earth staples if needed. Then cover with mulch. Depending on what I am planting, I may cut X's in the cardboard and plant immediately, then mulch. This would work with substantial perennials or when making a shrub border, for instance. And I have even planted pumpkin seeds in X's the same day if I pre-weeded. With delicate little transplants or when I'm suspicious that the underlying weeds might need time to settle, I wait. With the worst weeds, I might fork them out, then solarize the area with plastic for a month or longer in a hot, sunny season. Then remove the plastic and follow the steps of cardboard and mulch. I also use the cardboard or newsprint system here and there in a spot approach when an area of an existing bed has gotten weedy, such as the edge adjacent to lawn or good size patches between plants. Again, most important, the paper can be hydrophobic, repelling water. Don't just set it and forget it, or plants will suffer. If the soil is dry and you layer cardboard on, rain won't penetrate until the paper softens. So don't maroon little plants in the island of cardboard without life support. Water the area before smothering, moisten the paper, and water individual plants regularly via the X's. I suppose I got my lazy gardener inspiration first from the late Ruth Stout and her approach to no-work gardening, something like what people call lasagna gardening, a term I loathe. I think of it as passive composting in place and advocate for rigorous mulching with the right materials. If you have a spot that needs the more serious intervention of double digging to the 24 inches I once did, the longtime modern master is John Jevons of Ecology Action in California. He admired Stout, but quite correctly said that her no-work methods aren't suitable for all soils. His classic book, How to Grow More Vegetables, one of my first garden books, many printings ago, includes the how-to of what he calls bio-intensive gardening, including soil prep, and there are YouTube videos as well. How to Shop for Plants. The first week garden centers reopen here can be perilous, particularly if the winter has been ugly. I suggest shopping with the strategy etched in mind, along the lines of the suggestion not to do the grocery marketing when hungry, especially not without a specific list. To appeal to our appetite for color, the smart nursery staff will have assembled all the current show-off plants near the parking lot, so there is no avoiding their temptation. Lower your eyes and make a direct route to a helper at the counter, asking two questions. Where are the plants that looked good in February? And where are the plants that will look good in November? I suspect that you, as I, already have plenty of spring bloomers, since we generally shop in person in spring. Do that long enough, and all those impulse buys will catch up, yielding a big show followed by hits and misses. We must shop to fill in and extend and work toward that 365-day garden goal. I go in search of plants to serve a mix of functions. Ephemerals and other early birds. Herbaceous woodlanders and so-called minor bulbs, the mostly miniature opportunists that start the season before it seems possible, extending it here back into March or even February. Witch hazels, hellebores, and pussy willows come to mind. Late show stars. Plants that stretch things at the other end of the season, whether late bloomers like perennials, Lespedeza thunbergi, a big herbaceous mound of pea-like purple or white blooms, or fruiting plants like winterberries or some of the oriental ornamental grasses that age well. An army of soldiers. Durable, unfussy plants with a long season of interest, often from colorful and texturally pleasing foliage, such as painted ferns or epimedium, or low-growing sedum, and so many more. True powerhouse plants. The ones that fit into more than one of the previous categories, starring in multiple seasons, like viburnum, crabapples, broadleaf evergreens, and colorful conifers. Imperfect but irresistible types, plants with regrettably short peak moments. But even so, you cannot live without them. For me, this category includes lilacs and partagon lilies, one-trick ponies you cannot build a garden of unless the soldiers and powerhouse plants are there to support them. I shop with these functional categories and my color palette firmly in mind because in each month and also at each design level or layer, from ground cover up to shrub or tree or climber, I can strengthen that theme. If I like red, which I do, I want red from late March with ground covering Pulmonaria rubra into June with vining Lonicera sempervivens and the small tree called red buckeye. On to summer and fall fruits of mid-size viburnums and hollies to hot red fall foliage, too. See how it works? Also, avoid bringing home just one of anything herbaceous for a change. Areas that suffer from too many disparate polka dots of one-off plants could use some more sweeps and waves and other kinds of repeats to make it all hang together. Ephemerals. Ephemerals are plants that come and go in a relatively short time, making their days with us all the more precious. Though the term can simply mean short-lived or short-lasting, we typically apply it to a number of coveted early springtime plants, that complete their life cycle before the heat of summer comes on, emerging, reaching flowering size, then fruiting or setting seed and returning back underground for dormancy most of the year. Many of the best-known ephemerals in my region are native eastern woodlanders, like various atrilliums, Virginia bluebells, and bloodroot. If you think about where their species originated, beneath deciduous trees, you get the answer to how they evolved to this catch-me-while-you-can lifestyle. Once the trees leaf out, light on the forest floor would be in short supply, so by necessity they learned to hurry. How quickly they do the last bit, going dormant, can vary according to zone and even the weather in a particular season, or whether you water, which can slow the disappearance. Heat will send them packing faster than a prolonged, moist, and cool spring. In my garden, many ephemerals don't go fully dormant at all, or do so quite late into summer, but I know that in friends' more southern yards they do. Sometimes in a mere 6 to 8 weeks, start to finish. Bloodroot, even here, is fleeting. For example, so is Dutchman's breeches and squirrel corn. But three other early favorites, Marybelle's, blue cohosh, and twin leaf, remain standing, flowerless, but present and accounted for. All ephemerals are woodlanders. Other habitats have their temporary headliners, including the prairie, which features shooting star and prairie smoke, among others, that then enjoy the protection afforded by the taller grasses and forbs of summer. These plants and the natural plant communities they hail from, how they are constructed with a sequence of companions, have much to teach us about layering plants into our borders so they work visually over longer seasons of interest and also work functionally. Landscape architects and authors Thomas Rayner and Claudia West are inspiring many gardeners today, including myself, to pay attention to this issue and learn to plant smarter, using not just minor bulbs, but also ephemerals can jumpstart your season and also stretch the opportunities for local pollinators. Like the little bulbs, they kindly disappear and leave room for some main season shade plant to show off next. Some gardeners view this disappearing act as a liability, but I say not so. Think of ephemerals as opportunity makers instead, and plant something alongside that is glad to share the space. And our next subject is dividing trilliums. Maybe it was while fixing something or painting the house all those years ago, for some forgotten reason, I was down at ground level peering under the front porch, and there they were in near darkness, two tiny trillium plants, specifically northeast native Trillium erectum, the wake robin with reddish flowers. I rescued them, and you know how it goes when a plant repays you for your help. Thanks to those first two and to a tip handed down from a great gardener about dividing them when they're in flower, I have many. The books and many experts often recommend waiting until late summer or fall to do so, but the aha that they are easier to locate at bloom time before they go dormant and didn't mind being divided then was imparted to me and Ken Drews by Evelyn Adams of Wellesley, Massachusetts, when we visited her garden awash in trilliums one spring, working on Ken's 1994 book, The Natural Habitat Garden. He and I have been doing it this way, not waiting, ever since. The Trillium rhizomes are barely below the soil surface, so you hardly have to dig. Each division must have at least an eye or growing point, but I don't cut them up. I just gently tease apart the clumps descended from those two rescued ones and replant each rhizome. They'll need to be watered well, especially the ones that have top-heavy flowers, then babysat till they resettle. My favorite day to do this is a rainy one. Hopefully, I needn't remind you, but wild plants must never be dug for this or any purpose. Commercially, trilliums are ethically propagated by seed, a 4 to 7 year process. So next time you balk at the price, think about that. And our next title is Planting Peas with Mendel in Mind. And we'll probably just start this and we'll start again the next program. Since I first cultivated a vegetable garden, planting peas has been the task that marked its start. One recent March, I approached the welcome ritual with new reverence for the genetics built into the single Picum sativum seed and with diversity of various varieties to sow. It was 2013, and I had just audited an online class at MIT called Introduction to Biology, The Secret of Life. The professor, Eric Lander, one of the principal leaders of the Human Genome Project, had been teaching it for 20 years, almost as long as I'd been planting peas. It was the first time he'd taught it simultaneously online, so besides the classroom full of MIT undergrads, there were thousands of us unseen virtual types learning about subjects that, to my delight, included Gregor Mendel and his early genetic experiments with peas. And we have run out of time for today's episode of Out in the Garden. Be sure to listen next time. We hope you've enjoyed it. I'm Anna Dean Silver, reading for the North Carolina Reading Service. The content of this program is intended for people who are blind and print impaired. Out in the Garden is available as a podcast at our website, ncreadingservice.org. If you have any comments or questions, please call 919-832-5138. That number again is 919-832-5138. And thank you for listening to the North Carolina Reading Service. And our next podcast will start again with Planting Peas with Mendel in Mind.